are a nation that at our best has been defined by hope and not fear. A country that went through the crucible of a civil war to offer a new birth of freedom, that stormed the beaches of Normandy, climbed the hills of Iwo Jima, that saw ordinary people mobilize to extend the meaning of civil rights. That's who we are. That's what makes us stronger than any act of terror. Remember that history.
That was President Obama in his last national security speech. And one can't help but think that it was directed, absolutely directed, at the incoming president. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Fire You Can't Put Out, episode number 189, They Thought They Were Free, part 2. So where we left off last week was I pointed out that it was hardworking white Americans who thought that they were slighted, who thought that they were being economically disenfranchised, who thought that they were the target. And that is why they picked Donald J. Trump to be their representative, to be president. And by the way, and that's what you need. He needs a lot of white votes because outside of white people, not a lot of other folks voted for him. A lot of people were holding on to this idea, you know, this last gasp idea that perhaps the Electoral College would get together. Man, the Electoral College would get together. And that they would not vote for Donald Trump, because every time the Electoral College gets together, they always do. What they do always reflects, you know, what happens on voting day. And it's not the popular vote, it's the Electoral College, it's the electoral votes. And this year, even though a lot of people were in denial, thinking, gosh, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. This is our last ditch. This is our last ditch effort. He's not going to become president. Holy crap, he's not going to become president.
The Electoral College cast its votes for Trump for president Monday using a system set up by slave owners designed to override the power of the popular vote. Nearly 3 million more Americans cast their ballots for a different president. Just 538 people decided our political fate. White supremacists like former Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke are giddy about the racist neo-Nazi movement's prospects under Trump. Duke says appointments like Alabama's Jeff Sessions as Attorney General mean the KKK Nazi movement is on the march.
Bannon, Flynn, and Sessions as Attorney General, I believe, are the first steps in taking America back.
And by taking America back, they mean making America white. Safe for white people and safe for nobody else. So, the Electoral College, yes, they voted for this guy. And there's something interesting, and I don't think a lot of folks realize some of the relics that we have left behind from the free states versus the slave states. One of the things that we have is, of course, the Second Amendment. When the Constitution was being drafted, the Southerners wanted to make sure that they had more access to weapons because they wanted to keep up their slave patrols. And so there's a huge part of Second Amendment history that is steeped in slavery. Yeah, I know gun nuts are going to try to say, that's not true. That's not just all about freedom. No. There's a good chunk of it that's about slavery. And of course, one of those other things is the Electoral College. And the Electoral College went like this. Obviously, the North won the Civil War. And as such, we do not have slavery. Southerners were not happy about this. But clearly, they weren't just beaten by might, but they were beaten by a majority. A majority of people did not want slavery anymore. It's an economic system. So the Southerners, they wanted it. They wanted to keep it. They wanted to keep black people in shackles. It was just, they saw them as not. So they said, here's the thing. Part of the compromise will be this. We will give northern states, we will allow their slaves to vote. But their votes will only count for 3/5 of a human being. We agreed to that. And then they said another thing, the Electoral College. Because obviously the northerners will win out every time if it's just the popular vote. So we need to tilt the scales a little bit so that southern states have a little bit more say. This from Professor Akhil Reed Amar.
The Electoral College was designed by the framers of the Constitution. The idea of having direct popular election was floated. James Madison said, that's a good idea, but here's the problem with it. If we have direct election, the North will outvote the South every time. Let's have a different system in which each state will get a certain number of electoral votes based on that state's population, and in that calculation, slaves can be factored in, albeit with a discount, a 3/5 discount. So the Electoral College enabled the South to have more weight in the system than it would have had in a direct election system. Thomas Jefferson got an extra boost because the Southern states got to count their slaves, 13 extra electoral votes in the election of 1800. The Electoral College isn't because the framers were anti-democratic. It wasn't because they're trying really to create a balance between big and small states. It's more because they needed to balance the interests of the free states against the interests of slave states. It was part of a compromise, and a compromise with slavery.
And this year, the Electoral College did what it was supposed to do, and that was to protect the slave states and not the free states. There's an article over at Truthout by Henry Gouraud, and it's titled White Nationalism in the Oval Office and the Suppression of Dissent. And this is our country now. This is what we will be living under for the foreseeable future. And so this is what we need to understand about what's coming. Now, I explained in the last one, a lot of hardworking people turned out and voted for Trump as president because they believed that he was going to be there for them. Well, he's not going to be there for them. He's only going to be there for the incredibly rich. That's it. But in order to get there, there's not a lot of rich people, or at least certainly not enough to put him in office. So he had to stir up some racial resentment. And that racial resentment doesn't just go away after the election's over and he's been elected. A lot of folks see it as a legitimization of these white nationalist views. And there are now white nationalists who will be working in the White House. There are white nationalists in news organizations who will be spreading Nazi propaganda. This is our country now. This is what we've brought ourselves to. And we've done it all in the name of nativism and of the belief that immigrants, brown people, are ruining the country. Quote, under President Trump, Americans are entering a historical conjecture in which intolerant and racist ideologues are ascending to top White House posts. Some of the most egregious appointments thus far have included Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, Steve Bannon as White House Chief Strategist, Mike Pompeo as the head of the CIA, and Tom Price as the Secretary of Health and Human Services. All of these men are poised to promote policies that will increase the misery, suffering, and policing of the vulnerable, sick, and poor. In increasingly overt ways, racism is becoming the majority ideological force for establishing terror as a weapon of governance. Not only did Trump make law and order a central motif of his presidential campaign, he also amplified its meaning in his attacks on the Black Lives Matter movement and his depiction of black neighborhoods as cauldrons of criminal behavior. The repressive racial state is certainly to intensify and expand under Jeff Sessions, a strong advocate of mass incarceration and the death penalty and a white nationalist spokesman for the Old South. Sessions made his racist principles clear while appearing on the Matt and Ani show on WAPI. Sessions praised Trump's stance on capital punishment by pointing to Trump's 1989 newspaper ads advocating the death penalty for 5 young men of color accused of raping a jogger in Central Park. Sessions made these comments knowing full well that the Central Park 5, as they're known, were not only exonerated by DNA evidence after serving many years in jail, but were also awarded a wrongful conviction settlement, which ran into the millions of dollars. Moreover, Sessions was aware that Trump had later criticized the settlement, calling it a disgrace, while suggesting that the Central Park Five were guilty of a crime for which they should not have been acquitted in spite of testimony of Matthias Ray, who eventually confessed to the raping and attacking of the victim. Let's focus a little bit on Steve Bannon, the pick of White House chief strategist. While the head of Breitbart News, Bannon courted white nationalists, neo-Nazi groups, and other far-right extremists. In doing so, Amy Goodman points out he helped to rebrand white supremacy and white nationalism for the digital age under the euphemistic brand of the alt-right. Bannon is on record stating that only property owners should vote, stating that his ex-wife that he did not want to his ex-wife that he does not want his twin daughters going to school with Jews, calling conservative commentator Bill Kristol a Republican spoiler renegade Jew, and publishing incendiary headlines on Breitbart's website such as, quote, "Would you rather your child had feminism or cancer?" and birth control makes women unattractive and crazy. Even before Trump takes office, the threat of authoritarianism is becoming visible, exploding in our face through racist attacks on school children, the proliferation of swastikas around the country, name-calling, death threats, and a general atmosphere of hate, in the words of Rebecca Gould.
New York Giants football player targeted by hate. Someone broke into Nikita Whitlock's New Jersey home. Valuable items were taken, but disturbing signs were also left behind. Whitlock spoke exclusively to CBS 2's Valerie Castro. She's live at MetLife Stadium now with more for us. Valerie.
Christine, the Giants player, says this is actually the second time his home has been broken into in just a matter of weeks. But this time, the vandals took things to a different level.
When I first walked in, this is the first thing I saw.
This swastika, now hidden behind a sheet to protect his six-year-old son, is one of many pieces of graffiti on the walls of Nikita Whitlock's home in Moonaki, New Jersey. Some are so crass, we had to blur them out. Among those we can show you, this KKK scrawled on a wall in the basement apartment. This piece says, "Go back to Africa."
Recently, Trump tweeted out that anybody who burns the American flag should lose their right to vote, should lose their citizenship. And quoting from the story here, how else to explain the motive behind Trump's consideration of Milwaukee Sheriff David Clark as a potential candidate for the Department of Homeland Security? Trump is trying to crush dissent, trying to crush outside voices. He only wants to hear from his brown shirt supporters. Quote, Clark has referred to Black Lives Matter movement as the Black Lives Matter and has compared it to ISIS. Grace Guinerney reports in Alternate that Clark has proposed that terrorist and ISIS sympathizers in America need to be rounded up and shipped off to Guantanamo, and has stated that it is time to suspend habeas corpus, like Abraham Lincoln did during the Civil War. He guessed that about several hundred thousand or even a million sympathizers in the United States would need to be imprisoned. It is difficult to believe that this type of egregious call for representative state violence and a disregard for the Constitution supports rather than disqualifies somebody for such a high-ranking office. To some, it might seem like a trivial matter, but Trump's weaponizing of Twitter against critics and political opponents functions not only to produce chilling effects on critics, but also gives legitimacy to those willing to suppress dissent through various modes of harassment and even the threat of violence.
Oh, I do. I do think that, bigots, racists, misogynists feel legitimized and justified by this election, which is why I hope that Donald Trump does much more to lower the temperature. When you this election was like boiling water. When you put water to boil and the thing starts to bubble, once you turn off the stove, it still takes a long time for that water to go back to being room temperature. Anything and everything that Donald Trump can do to get us back to room temperature, to get us back to a more civil area, he should be doing. And that includes not tweeting angry tweets against Jeff Saloni, our colleague, or CNN, or Hamilton cast, or whatever. You know what I mean? Look, when a two-year-old throws a tantrum, he throws himself on the floor and he starts kicking and screaming. When 70-year-old Donald Trump throws a tantrum, he goes to Twitter.
Frank Cessno, director of the School of Public Media Affairs at George Washington University, is right in stating that anybody who goes on air, like I'm doing right now, or goes public and calls out the president, has to then live in fear that he is going to seek retribution in the public sphere. That could discourage people from speaking out. Case in point, such actions could also threaten their lives, as Chuck Jones found out after the president-elect called him out. He received an endless stream of harassing phone calls and online insults, even some threatening him and his children. According to Jones, nothing says that they're going to kill me, but they tell you, you better keep an eye on your kids. We know what kind of car you drive, things along those lines. Chuck Jones was the head, or is the head, of the union that represents the carrier workers in Indiana. And after he went on TV and pointed out that Donald Trump lied his ass off about the deal that he made with Carrier to try to keep jobs here in America, and Trump tweeted out how awful Chuck Jones is, and he didn't give anyone his phone number or anything, people were just able to find it through all kinds of public ways, and were calling his house, mailing him letters, sending him emails, and not directly threatening, but saying, hey, you know what, we know where you live, we know what you look like, we know you better watch your kids, things of that nature. And that's what's going to start happening to people who speak out against the president. But Melvin, you're speaking out against him right here. You're damn right I am. Because I'm not just going to let this stuff slide. I refuse during this administration to just sit here and be what they refer to as a good German.
Ezra, let me ask you about this. Have you talked with your reporters at Vox about how to properly cover the more racist elements of the alt-right?
I have, and this is tricky. So one, I want to say there has been a real uptick in hate that we see. So everybody at my organization has had anti-Semitic mail sent to our homes. People have had their addresses published online. You get friends and colleagues who are being photoshopped onto folks going into an oven in digital imagery. This has been, it's hard to cover also because it feels so personal to people, right? And it scares them. It's also a scary thing to cover because folks feel like it makes them into more of a target. As you say,
mean by covering the alt-right, by covering the racist elements of this movement, it creates a target.
Yes, exactly. Mm. And as you say, the trick in covering this is, one, not to normalize it, and not to, but also not to make it overly broad. The videotape that The Atlantic caught is chilling, but it also isn't something that should be attached to all Trump supporters, not something that should be attached to Donald Trump.
When he talks about the Atlantic video, he's talking about the neo-Nazis that were caught on video saying, "Hail Trump, hail our people, hail victory," and they were doing the Nazi salute. And Ezra Klein is saying, you know, let's try not to attach this to all Trump supporters. I'm not going to be that diplomatic. Because whether or not that was your intention, was to whether it was to empower Nazis or your voter, just because you just thought you were just going to get a better job. What you did, in effect, is you empowered Nazis. This from Greg Palast from his book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, A Tale of Billionaires and Bandits. A fact, quoting here, there aren't enough white guys to elect Donald Trump unless Trump's, and this is before the election, Trump's crew quietly builds a secret blacklist of millions of voters, especially voters of color, and systematically and quietly wipes out their voter registrations. In fact, in 2016, the voter erasing system has been built, and GOP operatives have already begun to put it into action. Its name is Interstate Crosscheck. I mentioned this in the last show. Crosscheck, not the voters, may well choose the next president and determine who controls the Congress. The number of voters on the Crosscheck list, over 7.2 million.
Electoral officials in 27 states have launched a massive new campaign against voter fraud. They are using a computer name matching system to claim that more than 3 million citizens may be registered to vote in more than one state. Now, the lists are based on common names like John Jackson or David Lee.
So what they're doing with the Interstate Crosscheck list is they're finding names like, say, oh, they know a lot of African Americans have the last name Washington. And they go, so they find a, say, Michael Washington in this state, and they mix and match it up with a Michael Washington in another state. And even though one may be Michael J. Washington, and one might be Michael W. Washington, and one might be 37 years old, and one might be 56 years old, they go, you know what? These are clearly the same people, and they wipe both of them off the rolls. That's two people on both sides that have been wiped off the rolls. So let's get into this number. 7.2 million people are on that list, and a lot of them do not find out that they don't have the right to vote until they show up on voting day. And then they're given a provisional ballot, which generally isn't counted unless the election is contested. And yeah, of course, with this, a lot of people are going to be wiped off the rolls of color. There might even be a few white people. I'll tell you what, I'm not going to give you my legal name. My legal name, both my first name, I know, it's weird. Melvin Mausoleum is not my real name. It's crazy. But I wonder if they'd wipe Melvin Mausoleum off the rolls. There's probably not another one of those guys. Anyway, I digress. So I have a really common name, a really common first name, a really common last name. I'm not going to give you my legal name, but let's just assume my name is John Smith, right? This John Smith. Well, a lot of John Smiths are white, so we're not going to wipe him off the rolls. But of course, say Jose Rodriguez, well, put that name on the list, because there's definitely another Jose Rodriguez in another state. And that guy's likely to be Mexican. And so you know what? Clearly, even though they have different middle initials, even though they have different birth dates, these guys both need to be wiped off the rolls. 7.2 million. I made the comment that Hillary Clinton needed to win. And win not just by a little, by a lot. So with the popular vote, she won with over 2.8 million votes in the popular vote. And there are 7.2 million people on the cross-check list. So if you add those together, and I just pulled a number out of thin air. I said she needs to win by 8 million, 10 million, you know. If you take the 2.8 that she won by in the popular vote, the 7.2 million that were wiped off the voter rolls, that's 10 million people. Now, there's no way to guarantee that all 7.2 million of those voters would have definitely voted for her. But the reason their names ended up on this cross-check list, this interstate cross-check list, is because their names sounded like they might not be white. This specifically went after names that are more likely to belong to people of color. So it's likely that some of the people on the interstate cross-check list were white, were wiped off, and were Republican, fine. But by and large, the Republican Party knows that they can't win a majority of any other group except for white people. So that's what interstate cross-check was designed to do. It was designed to protect white people while wiping people of a different skin color off of the voter rolls, because they're more likely, those people are more likely to vote Democratic.
There are right now 20 plus states implementing voter restrictions to try to take, to reduce the number of people who can vote, which we know will have a disproportionate impact on poor and minority communities, including black people.
Quoting from the article here again, it's a list I'm not supposed to have and you're not supposed to see. You're not supposed to know the names of the millions of voters who have had their voting rights assassinated. This is, again, from Greg Palast. But I've got the list. At least 3 million of the names are those who are about to get the royal screwing. I've got their names and I've got their colors. How I got them, that's my job. I'm an investigative reporter. Crosscheck is the GOP's great white hope machine, the approaching Death Star of voter suppression. There is a billionaire that is helping to back this effort. Trump has a sugar daddy. And the host of the billionaire's private bash is the only man on the planet to pocket a $5 billion salary in a year. That's $5 billion. He's JP, the foreclosure king. And if you haven't heard of JP, Trump's billionaire backer, well, that's the thing. You're not supposed to. And then, of course, Trump says, what about these 3 million votes, right? These 3 million people that voted for Hillary Clinton instead. So what the Trump group does is they say, aha, clearly 3 million people voted illegally.
What do you do when he says something like millions of voters voted illegally in California when you know that that's not true?
Well, I don't know if that's not true, John. No one really knows. I mean,
but you
don't
think millions
know
of people
true.
You think millions of people
it's
voted
possible.
Illegal?
That's Ryan Priebus helping to keep alive the lie. See, shrinking demographics are ensuring that the Republicans will not be able to hold power for much longer if they continue to traffic in white supremacy in order to hold on to power. Because the number of white people is shrinking a little bit. White supremacists call it white genocide. I simply call it America, the melting pot, because that was what I learned in school. And so there are a lot of folks, even people that I know, who believe that the reason for interstate cross-check is, they say, voter fraud. Even people that I know that I love, because they hear so much about it from conservative media, are going, you know what, there might be some voter fraud.
There have been just 4 documented cases of voter fraud in the 2016 election. 4! There were fewer cases of voter fraud than there are acceptable spellings of Hanukkah.
4 votes that turned out to be fraud. 4! 7 million people get wiped off the rolls for 4 people. Voter fraud is not a real thing, but there are a lot of people who believe that it is, and the lie is put out constantly. See, that legislator in Washington State that I mentioned on the last show, who wanted to make protesting a felony. If you're out there protesting for progressive causes, he wants to make protesting a felony, because a felony will ruin your life. So he believes that if he makes protesting a felony, people will not hit the streets and protest Mr. Trump. Voting illegally already is a felony. If you vote illegally, if you vote twice, that is a felony. It makes no sense in a country where we have people getting folks to the polls at all. The fact that somebody would risk getting a felony to cast an extra ballot doesn't make any sense.
Voting is a privilege in this country, and you need to be legal, not like California, where 3 million illegals voted.
Let's talk about that.
I'm glad I brought that up, Allison.
Me too, Paula. So where are you getting your information?
From the media. Where else are we getting? Some of it was CNN, I believe.
CNN said that 3 million illegal people voted
in California? Well, it was coming all across the media. All across. But CNN didn't do it. Then they were being smart this time.
Do you think that 3 million illegal people voted?
I believe in California that there were illegals that voted.
How many?
I don't. To tell you the truth, nobody really knows that number.
But do you think 3 dozen or do you think 3 million?
I think there was a good amount because the president told people that they could vote, and it happened in Nashua. We caught some people that they went into Nashua and they said, the president said I can vote. I'm here illegally.
Did you hear President Obama say that illegal people could vote?
Yes. I heard it this morning.
Tell me, where?
You can find it. Google it. You can find it on Facebook.
All right. Hold on. I don't want to waste any more time, but anyway, I see where it came from, and it's Fox Business Network deceptively edited a clip of Barack Obama to argue that the president encouraged illegal immigrants to vote, when in fact he had said nothing of the sort when you go back to the transcript.
You, as you sit here today, think that millions of illegal people voted in this country. You believe that there was widespread voting abuse.
I think there was in some states.
In the millions of people?
California allows it.
They do not allow illegal. You mean voter fraud California allows?
I believe there is voter fraud in this country.
You can't see it in that audio clip, but that reporter took and put her hand on her head, just exasperated at the stupidity of these conservative Trump voters. But they believe this, and I love when people lie to me, you know, tell me a falsehood, and then put the onus on me to go find the evidence. I heard it on the media. You can Google it. I don't want to Google it. You're the one spreading the lie. Tell me where you got the lie. You should just Google it. You should just look it up. No, you're lying to me. The onus on you for evidence. The onus is on you. Don't lie to me and tell me to go look it up, because I'm going to look it up and I'll find out that you're lying. And then when I find out you're lying, I'm going to go, oh, well, you can't believe the liberal press. The liberal press. Oh, now it's that line of BS.
This is from TDMSResearch.com. And Wisconsin, according to the exit polls, Hillary Clinton won by 3.9%. According to the actual vote total, Donald Trump won by 0.9%. That's a 4.8% discrepancy. So, and that happened in a big way in four states, in North Carolina, in Pennsylvania, in Wisconsin, and in Florida. In each one of those states, the exit polls showed that Hillary Clinton won, and the vote total showed that Donald Trump won. And had those four states stayed in the Democratic column, both at the presidential level and in the Senate, the Democrats today would control both the Senate and the White House.
It's a lie. Voter ID, it's a lie. It's voter suppression. There is no voter fraud. I'm sorry. There were four cases this year. And by the way, one of those cases was actually a Trump supporter who decided to try to vote twice because she heard in conservative media that you can go out and vote twice and you won't get caught. When she tried to vote twice, she voted at one place, then she went to another polling place and tried to vote again. She got caught and she went to jail because that's what happens when you try to do this kind of thing. It's a lie. There is no voter fraud. There are a lot of people who would rather believe that lie. The strategy here is to keep eligible voters away from the polls based on who they're going to vote for. And Republicans have figured out that the most reliable way to keep Democratic voters away from the poll is by keeping brown people away from the poll. Robert Gleason is the head of the GOP back in 2012. And he mentioned how, you know what, yeah, they didn't win that year, but they did reduce the number of votes that Barack Obama got by voter ID.
We cut Obama by 5%, which was big. And he beat McCain by 10%. He only beat Romney by 5%. I think that probably voter ID had helped a bit in that.
He said something that he wasn't supposed to say right there. He kind of let the cat out of the bag. He wasn't supposed to point out that the point was to reduce how much Democrats win by. But he said it because in a moment of candor, the kind of candor that he has around other Republicans, he didn't realize when he was sitting down to this interview that he wasn't supposed to say that. But they let it out right there. And these are the kind of things that they're saying in these quiet little rooms. They get together and they're trying to find ways to keep people from voting. And the best way to keep Democrats from winning is to make sure that Latinos, that Asians, that Muslims, that African Americans, essentially any non-white group stays away from the polls. Fox News pushes this lie all the time. And they know it's a lie, but they don't care. The point is to suppress the vote. And voter ID, interstate cross-check, it's doing that, and it's doing it with a passion. Oregon just got a Republican Secretary of State. First Republican Secretary of State they've had in something like 40 years. How long will it be before Oregon begins participating in interstate cross-check because they have a Republican Secretary of State? And how long will it be before thousands, if not tens or hundreds of thousands of Oregonians begin losing their right to vote because their name matches an ethnic name of someone else in another state?
This was an election about the status quo versus change. You know, all Hillary Clinton had to offer was that she wasn't Donald Trump. It wasn't enough.
When Ronald Reagan got one of his laws passed, the law was that children could pray in schools. That was the thing, right? He sits down in a radio studio and he's going to record sort of a short presidential piece. You know, it's going to be played on the radio about how excited he is that this piece of religious claptrap got passed, right? And so they're sitting in the studio, and I have a little studio here, so I know about all this stuff. And they're running levels, you know. I'll bring people into the studio to record with me, and I'll run some levels before we do the actual recording. And they're running levels, and they say, "All right, Mr. President, why don't you go ahead and speak?" And Ronald Reagan, in a joking manner, pipes up and says this.
My fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
Now, you can hear in the background, everybody's clearly laughing at him. This is just a joke, and this was not meant to be released. But what happened was, it got leaked. And when it got leaked into the press, of course, Russia found out about it. And when Russia found out about it, Russia declared that they were now in a state of war with the United States. We heard about this, and we get our weapons up. They've got their weapons up. We've got our weapons up. We get it figured out. Everyone lowers their weapons. But even that little joke, that just about wiped both countries off of the face of the earth. When the president says something, it matters, even when it's in supposedly, you know, a half-joking manner. Recently, President-elect Donald Trump has been saying on Twitter about how we need to have a new arms race, how we need to, and we've been reducing our nuclear weapons for some time because of a thing known as mutually assured destruction. There will not simply be us dropping a bomb, they dropping a bomb, you know, a few people die, we come to our senses, bombs stop. Nuclear weapons go on forever. There are bombs that have been dropped where 80 years later, people are still getting sick and dying from them. Nuclear weapons are dangerous. And they're going to wipe out a lot of people. And in a couple of weeks, this man-child, this Tropicana Hitler, is going to have the nuclear football. And he's going to be able to launch weapons at any time. And I'm not trying to scare the hell out of you, but what I am trying to say is that this is why we need to be engaged. I, here on this show, and a lot of my fellow progressives, we're going to become targets of this administration. And to great peril, a lot of things are going to happen to the country. A lot of things are going to happen to us. We might be thrown in jail. We might have our, you know, computer rights taken away, things of that nature. Because this president doesn't want to hear from us. He's very thin-skinned. But he's talking about doing some dangerous and horrible things. And I don't want to remain silent. And I don't think that anybody should. There's an article, and I use this term a lot, good German. And I don't mean it to slight German people. But in historical context, at the time, there were a lot of people during the reign of Hitler where they just continued on with their lives. During the Great Depression, they didn't call it the Great Depression. It was an economic downturn and all this other crap. Only after it was over did they refer to it as the Depression. The Holocaust was the same way. When the Holocaust was happening, they didn't refer to it as the Holocaust. A lot of folks referred to it as the matter of the Jews. A lot of them kept their jobs, they kept working during that time, and they just carried on as if none of this stuff was happening. It didn't concern them, no reason for them to be involved, no reason for them to speak up and say anything, no point in upsetting the apple cart. They just went on. But after the war was over, they looked back. Once it was referred to as the Holocaust, once they realized how awful things really got, they realized that perhaps they should have said something. There's an article over at The Guardian by Kate Connolly, and it's about a woman named Brunhild Promsell. The headline, Joseph Goebbels' 105-year-old secretary, quote, "Nobody believes me now, but I knew nothing." Joseph Goebbels was the head of the propaganda ministry, and Brunhild Promsell was his secretary. She wrote a lot of this stuff out. First of all, quoting here, Promsell is giving out the first and last in-depth interviews of her life. At the age of 105, having lost her eyesight last year, she said she is relieved that her days are numbered. "In the little time I have that's left, to me, I hope it will be months rather than years. I just cling to the hope that the world doesn't turn upside down again as it did then," she says. "Though there have been some ghastly developments, haven't there? I'm relieved that I never had any children that I have to worry about," she says. She goes on to say, quote, "Those people nowadays who say they would have stood up against the Nazis, I believe they're sincere in their meaning, but believe me, most of them would not have. After the rise of the Nazi Party, the whole country was under kind of a spell," she insists. "I could open myself up to the accusations that I wasn't interested in politics, but the truth is the idealism of youth might have easily led you to having your neck broken," she said. She recalls being handed the case file of the anti-Nazi activist Sophie Scholl, who was active in the White Rose movement at the time. Scholl was executed for high treason in February 1943 after distributing anti-war leaflets at the University of Munich. "I was told by one of Goebbels' special advisors to put it in the safe and not to look at it, so I didn't. I was quite pleased with myself that he trusted me, that my keenness to honor that trust was stronger than my curiosity to open that file." Promsell was 31 at the time and working for the state broadcast as a broadcaster as a well-paid secretary, a job she secured after she became a paid member of the Nazi Party when someone recommended her for a transfer to the Ministry of Propaganda in 1942. "Only an infectious disease would have stopped me," she insisted. "I was flattered because it was a reward for being the fastest typist at the radio station." She notes how her life for her vivacious, red-haired Jewish friend, Evan Lowell Thel, became increasingly difficult after Hitler came to power. Promsell was also shocked by the arrest of a hugely popular announcer at the radio station who was sent to a concentration camp as punishment for being gay. But she says that, largely, she remained in a bubble, unaware of the destruction being meted out by the Nazi regime on its enemies, despite the fact that she was at the physical heart of the system. "I know no one ever believes us nowadays. Everyone thinks we knew everything. We knew nothing. It was all kept a secret." She refuses to admit she was naive in believing that Jews who had been disappeared, including her friend Eva, had been sent to villages in the Sudetenland on the grounds that those territories were in need of being repopulated. "We believed it. We swallowed it. It seemed entirely possible. Only occasionally did she get a glimpse of the man who turned lying into an art form in the pursuit of the Nazis' murderous goals. She was terrified to see him on stage at Berlin Sportoplast, delivering his infamous Total War speech in 1943. She had known him as quiet and small, and she saw him ranting on stage about murder and war. It was the day after Hitler's birthday in 1945 that her life as she knew it came to an abrupt halt. Goebbels and his entourage were ordered to join Hitler in his subterranean air raid shelter, the so-called Führer bunker, during the last days of the war. "It felt as if something inside me had died," she said. "We tried to make sure we didn't run out of alcohol. That was urgently needed in order to retain the numbness." She lifts an index finger as she takes pains to tell events in the right order, recalling how Goebbels' assistant, Gunther Schwagerman, came with the news on April 30th that Hitler had killed himself, followed a day later by Goebbels. "We asked him, and his wife as well, and the children too, they were all dead." She bows her head, shakes it as she adds, "We were dumbstruck." Promsell told her colleagues that she would tell the truth, that she had worked as a shorthand typist on Joseph Goebbels' propaganda ministry. She was sentenced to 5 years incarceration in various Russian prison camps around Berlin. "It was no bed of roses," is what she will say about that time. "It was only when she returned home that she became aware of the Holocaust," she insists, referring to as the matter of the Jews. But it would take her another full six decades after the end of the war before she made any inquiries about her Jewish school friend, Eva. When the Holocaust Memorial was unveiled in 2005, she took a trip from her home in Munich to see it for herself. "I went into the information center and I told them I myself was missing someone, Eva Lowenthal. A man went through the records and soon tracked down her friend who had been deported to Auschwitz in November 1943 and had been declared dead in 1945. The list of names on the machine in which we found her just kept scrolling, nonstop down the screen, she said. She says, leaning her head back, the fingertips of one hand tracing the line of her necklace.
How did you process in the campaign not getting the kind of media coverage? And this is not Tavis kissing up to Bernie Sanders. The data is clear and everywhere about this. How did you process Trump sucking the air out of the room, the media room, that is, and Bernie Sanders having to fight to get coverage at all?
Look, we had the misfortune about speaking about the real issues impacting the American people. That's not a good way to get media coverage. You want me to get media coverage? Tavis Smiley is a dash, dash, dash. Wow, that's a lot. That's really interesting. Let's go through that. Bernie Sanders said this about Tavis. Tavis said this about Bernie. We can go on for weeks on that.
Mm-hmm.
But if I talk about why the middle class in this country is in decline, why we have a grotesque level of income and wealth inequality, well, you know, that's kind of wonkish.
Yeah.
That's kind of boring. Who wants to talk about that?
But Melvin, it couldn't happen again. Propaganda. Oh, you mean like Fox News and like Breitbart and like fake news. It couldn't happen again. We already have a propaganda ministry. We just don't call it that. But Melvin, we're not talking about rounding anybody up. Yes, we are. Yes, we are. We're talking about rounding up Muslims. Back then, it was Jews. Oh, and by the way, a lot of those Trump supporters that are crowing about how happy they are now that he's been elected, they're openly targeting Jews as well. But Melvin, it couldn't happen again. That is the kind of language that ensures that it will happen again. And the media, although not propaganda, the media played a gigantic role in not only giving this man airtime, no matter what he said, but continuing to protect him. Because of that, it was really hard for a legitimate candidate to come forward.
It's amazing how little discussion there is about what the Koch brothers actually stand for. Tavis, the Koch brothers don't want to cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and federal aid to education. They want to abolish it all. Abolish it. They want to take us back to the 1920s when working people, the middle class, poor people, had absolutely no rights at all.
And that is who has all of the power now in the new America. And Trump is doing everything in his power to bring people into his administration that will see to the destruction of the country, see to the destruction of our programs, social safety nets, all the things that make America, America. I understand that he's going to make America great. And perhaps what we believe makes America great is hate. But it is not. I believe it is the American spirit. It is ingenuity. It is kindness. It is love. It is looking out for one another. But you got to understand how old hat I am.
Let's talk about Trump's pick for Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. It's Ben Carson. He is a neurosurgeon. And many say that on paper, he lacks significant experience in housing and urban development. What do you think? Good move, Peter?
What on earth, besides the fact that he grew up poor and in an inner city, what on earth qualifies him for this job?
This is a world-class neurosurgeon who Harvard Center of Leadership gave him a leadership award for being one of the greatest leaders in his field.
Leadership skills are not transferable. You know what I mean? Like Ghostface Killer's the leader of Wu-Tang Clan, right? LeBron James, the leader of Cleveland Cavaliers. Doesn't mean they should be the leader of housing and urban development. He himself said, I don't know how to run an office. I don't know how to run a bureau. I don't know how to handle bureaucracy. I don't have any experience in government. So if he says that himself, why do you choose him to be the leader of one of the most significant departments in America?
And then, I think his own comments against the job is notable. I do think leadership skills are transferable,
exactly.
Though. That part I would disagree with.
Some are.
The headline, an open letter to my supposedly pro-choice, pro-sex, pro-same-sex marriage, non-racist Trump supporters. This from Robin Panetia over at Wonkette. The Washington Post published an editorial from former Wall Street Journal writer Azra Q. Nomani, titled, I'm a Muslim woman and an immigrant, and I voted for Trump. What it's meant to be is proof that Trump supporters could not possibly be racist or sexist or xenophobic if this lady was on their side. You know, because we've definitely never heard of someone taking sides against their own people before. I read the article. In it, Nomani explains that she is a lifelong liberal who supports the Democratic Party's position on abortion, same-sex marriage, and climate change. That she supports equal pay, that she voted for Trump because Obamacare is expensive. If you think Obamacare is expensive, wait until you see not Obamacare. Because Clinton and Obama weren't enthusiastic enough about saying radical Islam and ISIL instead of ISIS. Quote, yes, I want equal pay. No, I reject Trump's locker room banter and the idea of a wall between the United States and Mexico and a plan to ban Muslims. But I trust the United States won't buy the political hyperbole, agenda-driven identity politics of its own that demonized Trump and his supporters. She goes on, the checks and balances in America and our rich history of social justice and civil rights will never allow the fear-mongering that has been attached to candidate Trump's rhetoric to come to fruition. Here we go. First of all, nothing has been attached to Trump's rhetoric that he did not put there himself. He did all the fear-mongering himself. Second, we don't have checks and balances anymore. Congress is all Republican. The Supreme Court, if God forbid anything happens to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, we will all see Republican and anti-choice and anti-same-sex marriage people get on that court. You know what that means? Nothing's getting checked. Nothing's getting balanced. There is literally no one to stop him from doing anything that he wants to do. Oh, and for social justice and civil rights, those things don't happen because of a rich history. People fight for and work for them every day. How dare anyone take it for granted that this is just given to us? Say, but oh, I'm not a racist. I just wanted lower taxes, right? It's unfair the liberals think that we're all racist. How unfair is that, right? We just wanted to... No. Maybe you're not racist. Maybe you're not sexist. But you know what you are? You are worse than people who are openly sexist and openly racist. Because at the very least, they have squared with it and they say openly that they are both sexist and racist, xenophobic. They say, you say that you're not, and then you enable a man who is. So you say you're not racist. You totally support same-sex marriage, you're pro-choice. You just like him for his other policies. You want us to believe that you're a good person. You just wanted to vote against the establishment by voting for a rich white man instead of a rich white woman. You have had economic anxiety. You thought no health care was better than Obamacare, and you thought that if Trump took back manufacturing jobs that they would magically pay well without anyone fighting for it, because apparently you have no idea how the labor movement happened. The largest demographic of people who voted for Clinton, percentage-wise, were black women. Black women who have both sexism and racism to deal with, who also may have economic anxiety of their own that they will certainly be exacerbated by a Trump presidency. Black women who, let's be honest, already do most of the work when it comes to fighting both sexism and racism. And you, whatever you think of yourself, you just made it worse for them.
He promised when he was running for president that he would break the connection between Wall Street and this Congress. He said he was going to separate that from the government, no more revolving door. He wasn't going to do that sort of thing. And then what does he do? He turns around and picks a guy who had actually been one of the people who helped do all of those lousy mortgages that not only broke the economy, but broke millions of families. And then after the crash, a guy who turned around and bought a bank that then became infamous for how hard it squeezed families that had already been cheated, and was the foreclosure machine following that. The American people are furious over what Wall Street has done. They don't want somebody who's going to come in here and say, hey, let's help Wall Street. And what Donald Trump is doing is he's literally handing the keys to the Treasury over to a Wall Street banker who helped cause the crash.
He said he was going to get Wall Street and special interest out of the government, and then he hired two people from Goldman Sachs, people to the Treasury Department who are going to guarantee an economic crash that's not just going to hit black and brown people, it's also going to hit the dumb white conservatives that voted for Trump.
The nominee for the Secretary of Education slot is the most ideological and anti-public education nominee that any party has ever selected. How someone can be selected to be the chief spokesperson about the public schools and public education in America when they hate public education in America and have spent their adult lives undermining it is a real question.
American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten talking about Betsy DeVos. DeVos is an Amway and Blackwater billionaire whose family has crusaded to privatize public schools.
They want schools to be defunded.
Somebody who wants to destroy public education, possibly, potentially, creating more conservative voters. Betsy DeVos wants to get rid of the education system and replace it with churches so that you're only learning the facts, the fake facts that they come up with.
President-elect Donald Trump's choice of Exxon Mobil CEO Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State has drawn support from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and others, but critics say Tillerson's business dealings with Russia are a red flag. Iowa State University political scientist David Anderson adds that being involved in high-level international business is a different ballgame than international diplomacy.
There's a big difference between a business doing this and looking out for the bottom line and a country doing this and looking out for the nation in perpetuity.
Sources say that Trump also wants former Texas Governor Rick Perry to head the Energy Department.
It has been demonstrated that Rex Tillerson has worked against American interests. When we have decided to strike certain deals with other countries when it came to oil deals, and I'll get into more of this at a later date, Rex Tillerson, the head of ExxonMobil, has gone to those countries and said, don't deal with the United States, deal with us directly. And that includes Russia. We asked Rex Tillerson not to go to Russia, not to strike a deal with Russia. And he went there and he said, America who? We picked the Secretary of State who has actively worked against America. Think about that.
Chuck Jones, president of United Steelworkers Local 1999 at the Carrier plant in Indianapolis, says Trump, quote, lied his ass off, end quote, about saving Carrier jobs from being sent to Mexico. Jones says while it is true that some jobs were saved, hundreds more jobs from Carrier are still going to Mexico. And Carrier's parent company is getting $7 million in tax credits from Indiana to add insult to injury to the people of Indiana.
People got false hopes that they were going to keep their jobs. And when all the smoke cleared, 730 of our members were keeping jobs. 550 aren't going to have a job. That's not what he campaigned on. He campaigned on, I'm going to keep all the jobs here at Carrier in Indianapolis. They're not going to Mexico. He didn't deliver.
So what we have is all of these people hell-bent on destroying the government because you, the white people, believe that you were slighted by people of color, by people from different countries, that you were economically slighted by them, not the people that have actually harmed you, like these bankers and these oil companies that have openly worked for not only the destruction of your country, but have worked to economically disadvantage you. And then you believed that it was black and brown and Mexican and Muslim and all, it was all their fault and not the people who were actually in charge of doing this. And now when black people are being murdered by police and the Black Lives Matter movement rises up to speak out against it, you openly say that it's not a real movement. They don't have any real grievances. Let me tell you about the Little Rock Nine. When Little Rock, Arkansas decided to integrate their schools, there were nine people. I don't have time to name them now. But when they showed up for their first day of school, they were harassed and they were screamed at. And there was one woman named Hazel Bryant that ended up in a very famous photo because she got right in the face of a black woman named Elizabeth Eckford and was screaming in her face. And you could see the pure rage on Hazel Bryant's face. And later on, after that photo became famous, Hazel Bryant would go on to realize the error of her ways and realize that what she did was wrong. And she went back to Eckford and essentially said, you know, I was wrong. I shouldn't have done that. Forget about it. I'm sorry. Eckford lamented that true reconciliation can only occur when we honestly acknowledge our painful and shared past. Bryant didn't like that. It held a mirror in front of her. Her white guilt stared her right in the eyes. Bryant wanted Eckford to simply let it go. Quoting here from BePureBlack.com, she had apologized. So why wouldn't Eckford simply let it go? To this day, Brian doesn't understand why Eckford simply can't let it go. White people want blacks to forget what happened because it makes them uncomfortable. White guilt tells them that blacks should just let it go so that they don't feel guilty any longer. White guilt tells them that their tears are more important than the collective fears of the black Americans feel living in a racist society. White guilt tells them that they aren't privileged any longer because they have apologized. Whitegate guilt tells whites that blacks are obliged to be a court to their privilege. What Brian doesn't realize is that despite her apology, black people are always going to be black, and her apology doesn't exonerate black people from white oppression. So we're here now, and we find ourselves in this very precarious situation where white supremacy and racism now rule the country, where people work in the highest echelons of government to destroy the very government that you have benefited from. And to justify it all, they have told us that we need to strip these people of the right to vote, that we need to dismiss Black Lives Matter as a movement, and that it needs to be us, the white people, versus they, everybody else. White supremacists now have not just a seat, but many seats at the table, where they get to tell us about how we just need to go back to being white. These people just need to go back where they came from, never minding the fact that we brought them here in chains on boats, where a lot of them died along the trip. That we brought them here, made slaves of them, and now we're pissed that they are no longer slaves. And when these people, these masters of the universe, decide to destroy the government and destroy the U.S. economy, rather than owning up to it, rather than owning up to how they have screwed us all, they turn to us and they say, do you see that union worker? They are the problem. Do you see that Mexican? They are the problem. Do you see that woman in that workplace? She is the problem. They take the focus off of themselves and they turn it towards us. And now we are going down a familiar, historically, but very uncomfortable road for all of us. And for what? To protect the masters of the universe? Because we believe that some guy who has never worked a day in his life, who has never had to deal with any kind of consequence, a guy who directly benefited financially from the 2008 crash. We believe that not only does he give a crap about us, but he is going to help us out. Here's the truth. We have each other, you and I. We, the working class, although we may be from different parties and different races and different backgrounds and all the rest, we honestly share the same economic interest. It's not a black economic interest. It's not a white economic interest. It's not a Mexican or Muslim economic interest. We, as working people, whether you're a Democrat or Republican or whatever the piss you are, we share the exact same economic interest. And we, there are many more of us than there are of them. And that is why race is brought in. That is why race is being used to divide us, to keep us away from each other, to keep us from talking to each other, to keep us believing in crap like that global warming isn't real, to keep us believing in things like, well, we just need to strip people of the right to vote if we want real democracy to have a voice. We have the same interests. Yeah, we might disagree on dumb wedge issues like abortion and all the rest and guns. Those aren't the real issues. We're all being pickpocketed. Democrats, Republicans, we're all being pickpocketed. We're all getting screwed. There's a lot of people who are willing to go along with that. But if you hear me, and you're out there, and I know you are, this is where we need to draw the line. This is where we need to realize that we need each other. And that my interests, your interests, no matter what party you belong to, are honestly the same. And that we need to not buy in to racism. We need to not buy in to tribalism and xenophobia and nativism. Because these things are only going to further divide us. And nobody wins when that's the order of the day. Facts are not the problem. Muslims are not the problem. Mexicans are not the problem. The fact that people want a good living wage is not the problem. The problem is that there are very greedy people that we have just handed the keys to the country over to. And the only thing that they want to do is destroy it. And you openly and willingly gave them that power. America's still in a fragile state, and we are still an experiment, whether you realize it or not. But we are still here. We are still relatively whole, and we still have a chance. I've realized this through the course of doing this show and from talking to people. And I think if you're listening to this show, you realize that too. We just need to expand that audience. We just need to expand the amount of people that see it the way that we see it. Because if we continue to buy into the narrative that's sold to us by rich, white, greedy Republicans, well, then I suppose we're going to get exactly what we have coming to us. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. Our official home is tfycpo.podbean.com. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/tfycpo. You can listen on the go. Just download the Podbean app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store or on Podbean. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out. There you can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, hate mail, or just a general statement or inquiry, you can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and thank you for listening. This is Melvin signing off, and I'm not going anywhere. Now that I've woken you up, good morning.